Coming up at 6 o'clock, primetime sports. Jays are off tonight. They're back at home against Seattle tomorrow. Stampeders are in action. They'll kick off week 5 of the CFL at about 6:30 Calgary time. Really excited to welcome Olympian Duff Gibson into the hot... Well, it's not the Hot Stove Lounge. I guess it's our downtown studio. Thank you. I get that because I got the location wrong. Duff, you may remember, joined us in January, February, somewhere in there we had a conversation. And I'm trying to remember how it got brought to my attention. I think it was Canadian Sports Institute or somebody up at Winsport put out a press release talking about what you're doing. And I grabbed my attention, and you were kind enough to come on. And I thought we had a really fun conversation and a really important conversation about what your new company, Dark Horse Athletic, and we'll get to that in a second, but kind of your approach to sport, which is not necessarily the way everybody in the world is moving these days, especially with specialization and early specialization, which I want to get into as well, because, again, very important to me, and I think one of the most important topics out there when it comes to kids involved in sport. Having said that, I want to go back a little bit and just talk a little bit about Duff the Olympian, because Duff the Olympian is not your traditional Olympic story. Sir, a two-time Olympian, but your first Olympics at age 35, right? Does that sound about right?
That's right. Well, I was 39, so I count back 4 years, 35.
Yeah, 39 is when you won the gold medal, but 35 is when you competed right at the Olympics for the first time.
I have to use the math because...
I understand. Yeah. That's what I have Will. Will does all my math for me. Tell me a little bit about your journey in skeleton. We were kind of talking about it off the air, and it, you know, some might think because it just showed up at the Olympics, it's a brand new sport. It's not a brand new sport. It's the long traditional sport, but it came back to the Olympics just recently. How did you find skeleton, or how did skeleton find you?
Well, skeleton, ultimately, I tried many, many different sports because, let me go way back.
Sure,
to watching the Montreal Olympics in 76 as a 9-year-old about to turn 10.
Right.
And being completely captivated by it and loving every sport and thinking, I want to be a part of that. And I don't care what sport it is, because mm-hmm. they were all awesome. And then systematically trying sport after sport after sport where, you know, and when you do that, you're kind of a jack of all trades, master of none.
Sure.
And ultimately finding skeleton and sticking with it and taking it to the level that I was lucky enough to be able to get to, because what skeleton requires is what I was good at, and what it doesn't require, you know, what I'm not good at, you're not penalized for in skeleton.
Right.
In other words, it's what I call the physics of sport. You can't ignore the physics of sport. If you don't have a great lung capacity, then the aerobic side isn't going to work for you. You were all suited to mm-hmm. something. And ultimately I stopped and stuck with skeleton, and it worked because of the demands of that specific sport.
So take me back to 1976. As a 9-year-old, you decide you want to be in the Olympics, or you wanted to compete in sport?
You know, that was back in the Daryl Sittler days.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to be an NHL player.
Okay.
And then I saw the Olympics, and I wanted to be an Olympian. I wanted to represent my country. I wanted to be a part of that movement and what was so awesome about it. And a big part of that was also that I had, in grade 6, I had a volleyball coach who was a referee at the Montreal Olympics. And he told us, I remember him telling us this story where... and my impression, I don't know if he said who was competing, but my impression was that these were two elite teams competing for medals at the Montreal Olympics. He was a referee there, and someone hit it out. It went out of bounds. The referee awarded a point, and the team that would have benefited on the side out went to the ref and said, I touched it. And so it switched back to
sportsmanship.
It was sportsmanship. And that was at such a hugely impactful moment of my life, and my impression was that's what an Olympian does, and I wanted to be a part of that.
So how many different sports, how many different starts and changes till you got to skeleton then?
Well, I say 5 different sports where my mentality was, this is the one I'm going to take it to the Olympics. And that began with, my father competed in judo. So I started with judo when I was very young. And that sort of transitioned into the first sport for me in high school, which was wrestling.
Okay.
And so I was good at wrestling. I was a city champion a couple of times, but you know, man boys who could wipe the mat with me. So I moved on in university to rowing. I had an uncle who went to the 84 Olympics in rowing, actually. And then did that for, you know, and then I can, it depends how detailed you want to go.
Please,
here.
No, I'm fascinated by this. This is great.
So I, you know, being a hair under 6 feet tall, that's not conducive to rowing. I was a lightweight, so my height was fine for weighing under 160 or 165 pounds, but there was no lightweight at the Olympics. So ultimately, when I moved to Calgary, it was right after the 88 Olympics, and I'd watched Gaétan Boucher, and I thought, that's going to be it. I took up speed skating, and I was good enough to win provincials, but still, you know, top 10 in Canada, still not close enough to get to a level where I could compete for a world medal or an even Olympic spot. So I moved on from, I had a friend who was a bobsled coach, and he said, you're a sprint speed skater. Why don't you try some sprint training to make yourself a better sprint speed skater? And they needed an extra guy once bobsledding. And within a year I was ranked higher in bobsledding than I was in speed skating. So I switched to that, did that for a while, and I'll spare you the sob story of politics and sled costs and all this. And eventually 5 years later, or 6 or 7 years later, actually, I said, forget it. I'm switching to skeleton. Skeleton's going to be in the Olympic program. If I do well, it's because of me.
Right.
If I do poor, I don't have to rely on anybody else. For $5,000, I can buy literally the best equipment in the world that all my competition is competing on as well. And so that's where I landed, and that's what worked.
So at what age did you arrive at skeleton?
33.
So 2 years after getting to skeleton, you were in the Olympics.
That's right. Well, that's misleading, because I did 6 or 7 years of bobsledding before that. So
okay.
I was 2 years into skeleton, but all the concepts, all the training, all of the philosophies were transferable.
Okay, I understand. Okay, so you had the base anyway.
Right.
From, but nonetheless, at 33, my business teaches me that most people are moving on and retiring and leaving. You're just showing up. Did that not seem odd to you? Was that, I mean, Duff, did you ever wake up and go, what am I doing? Or was that just the way you were wired, the way you were programmed?
Well, my mom pointed out that it was odd that I was still that age and not moving on with my life yet. But when I joined the fire department, it was the same year I made national team for skeleton. So everyone was happy at that point.
Yeah.
I guess it was odd, but it was the people that I was competing with, my teammates, the women's team, none of them had a job. They were young and they just did this sport.
Mm-hmm.
On the men's team, they were all older, roughly my age, and all had careers as well. So it fit. I didn't seem out of place by it.
Duff Gibson, our guest live in studio here on Sportsnet 960, The Fan. What was it like then, balancing a full-time job, not a full-time job as a radio host or a full-time job as a, not there's anything wrong with being a librarian or anything, but you were a firefighter. That is by its own nature a very dangerous and strenuous job. And skeleton, I don't think I have to tell any of our audience, isn't exactly a walk in the park either. How did you balance the two?
Well, the two actually balanced fairly well.
Okay.
There is it's not why I became a firefighter, obviously, and I'm very proud to tell people what I do for a living.
Yeah.
But the job does afford you a bit of flexibility in terms of, you know, I'll work for you more in the summer if you cover some of my shifts in the winter, that sort
sure.
of thing. I worked at the airport at the time, or for most of my career at the with skeletons. So the airport is, or any fire hall, you're not paid for what you do necessarily so much as what you're prepared to do at any given time. And when you work at the airport, that's amplified to the extent that you hope you never have a crash.
Yeah.
But you prepare a lot, which involves one man trucks, gigantic, you know, 80 or 90 ton trucks where you sit in the middle and, you know, $1.5 million vehicle I'm driving around, and you spray foam and water on a simulated plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And so you train and train and train, and you don't actually use it very often.
Right.
So it wasn't physically demanding to do it. the way being a firefighter downtown, for example, and you if you had an alarm, a false alarm, let's say on the fourth floor, well, you're walking up four flights of stairs with 50 pounds of equipment that is just you,
mm-hmm.
an air tank and your gear, and then you're bringing hose and high-rise kits and that sort of thing too. So if you're going to a false alarm working downtown as a firefighter, it's a strenuous job. If you're working at the airport, you train a lot, but that's driving a giant vehicle and it's more a technical thing. So it wasn't really a conflict.
So 26 years after seeing the Montreal Olympics, you arrive in Salt Lake City for a Winter Olympics. Was that good enough? Was that, you know, I've done what I wanted to do, I'm okay? Or, you know, how did you feel finally getting to that point?
That was a real eye opener. I feel like I am very understanding and sympathetic of Olympians who don't do well at the Olympics, because I feel like I've had two completely contrasting experiences. Mm-hmm. One Olympics where everything went perfectly well, I followed the plan I wanted to, and I exceeded my expectations. And one where the Salt Lake Olympics, where, you know, I was 4 years younger than when I won, but someone asked me if I was a coach because they assumed I was older.
Yeah.
I won my first World Cup medal in the race before the Salt Lake Olympics. So I really thought I had a chance. I did have a chance at a medal, and I was fifth after the first run and made a mistake in the second run and dropped down to 10th. So it was a real negative experience, but I learned very quickly that I wasn't prepared to the extent that some of my competitors were.
Mm-hmm.
It was an eye opener in that regard.
Yep.
And that negative, that failure became a great motivation for me going forward.
2006, you go to Turin, you win the gold medal. What does that in turn mean? Because again, yours is what the Olympic movement is all about. Let's be honest. The Olympic movement is about inspiring, showing kids that athletics, there's meaning to it. There can be reward to it. You were inspired by 76. And here, yeah. in, you know, 30 years later, you win the ultimate in your sport. There had to be some sort of kismet to that. There had to be some sort of extra joy beyond just winning.
Well, it was very eye-opening in many different respects. It was being a rock star, mm-hmm. you know, your 15 minutes of fame,
yep.
and driving down from Sestriere into Torino for the medal ceremony in limousines and getting a call from Stephen Harper and, you know, police stopping the traffic so you can go through red lights.
Sure.
And that was short-lived, but it was wonderful. But it was also an eye-opener. There was also a great amount of relief, to be frank about it, because I see a lot of athletes who really struggle with that transition. My body, before I got there, a year or two before I got there,
mm-hmm.
told me I should probably be done. And, you know, 39, that's very old to be still doing that sort of thing. And I was getting signs that in fact, was I should be done. But it was also a reality check in the sense that I did achieve what as high as you can get in my sport,
yeah.
and life did not change at all. I had some wonderful opportunities. I get to speak to you,
mm-hmm.
and there's some weight that some people put on my opinion because I won a gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
But that almost is more of an eye opener, because I know I'm just me, and I know that nothing has changed, and what's important to me before is the same as after.
Is that an eye opener, or is that humbling? Because I have to think, as a 9-year-old boy watching, again, I love where the story starts, that, you know, you watch this, you want to be part of that. There had to be almost this mythical component to it. These are the best in the world. But then you get to, and you win a gold medal, but the bills still keep coming in. People still need you to pay on time, that sort of thing. Humbling, yep. or eye-opening?
There was so much. I would answer that by saying that I am as grateful as you could possibly be for the circumstances that led up to that happening.
Sure.
So I guess that falls in the category of humbling.
Sure.
And you could start with the genetic makeup that I was born with solely because of who my mother and father were, all mm-hmm. the way up to the specific demands of the track that they built for the Torino Olympics. Because some track, you know, I'm,
yep.
I'm very wide. I'm not good in a wind tunnel, but because I'm wide and stronger, let's say, I can steer a sled harder. So certain tracks I'm great at, certain tracks I'm terrible at, and that was perfect.
In conversation, Dove Gibson, our guest, gold medalist in skeleton, 2006 Torino Olympics. Was that going to be it?
It was. Yeah.
So you...
Worst case scenario, it was going to be, if I didn't win a medal in Torino, it was going to be the next fall, because the World Cup, the first World Cup of the following season was going to be in Calgary.
Okay.
But I had no illusions about physically making it long enough to do Vancouver.
So the last competitive run you made, won a gold medal.
Correct.
And I've
never been on a sled since, not a single time.
How cool, amazing is that? Because we talk about it, Lanny McDonald goes out as a Stanley Cup champion. John Elway goes out.
John Elway's
right?
There.
You know, there's a small select group of, you're only as good as your last, and your last was gold medal, best in the world. That is pretty cool.
I'm grateful. You know, it's funny. I'm grateful that it happened that way.
Yeah.
You mentioned John Elway. To me, that's as good
as
it gets.
Yeah.
But from my perspective, that's as good as I could possibly do, and I'm grateful for it. And I've had something you might find funny is that every once in a while, not recently, let's say not in, because it's been 10 years now since Torino, but I used to occasionally have a dream that I had made a comeback and was terrible. And I was so disappointed that I had made a comeback. But
well, you had that dream, but did you ever think about it? Was it ever there?
Physically, I couldn't compete anymore. And I was aware of that, but the technical aspect of it, you spend, as a coach, you spend a lot of time trying to get people to do something you can do inherently.
Right.
There's a lot of feel, body awareness.
Yeah.
And how do you teach someone to be more body aware? It's a difficult thing to do. And there were times when I thought, oh, I love to jump on a sled and show them one run, but I never did. And thank goodness. Because that's just ego, right?
Yeah, but it's funny. We were talking about it off the air that you were involved in a sport that there's no beer league skeleton, right? Like, it's not like you can just go out and play in charity skeleton runs and things like that. You know, you play a team sport, you can still go kick a ball, you can still play hockey with your buddies and stuff like that.
Yep.
You walked away. What about this dream, this chase of sport all the way to the Olympics? You get there. When it's done, what filled the void? Was it difficult? Did it take a while to come down is the wrong word, but to kind of find that peace?
It was difficult. It was difficult. It's I think I'm in a really good place with regard to that now.
Right.
What I learned was that the fun part for me wasn't, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I was thrilled to wear the maple leaf. I was thrilled to have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But the fun part, and I learned this from my competitors and from the best people that I came in contact with had the same belief. It has filtered into Dark Horse, actually.
Right.
That it's not about who's the winner. It's about growth. It's about challenging yourself. And so I competed against guys who would, from the bottom of their heart, wish you your best run and be the first person to shake your hand if you beat them.
Right.
And so that's no different now. You know, for me as a 210-pound mountain biker who will never be confused with a good mountain biker, is still loving the challenge of getting a little better and competing against the other 210-pound mountain bikers.
What I love about that is that goes all the way back to the teacher that was an umpire in volleyball and the story that they told you about this and the sportsmanship clicking to you. And then you fast forward to actually competing against guys that genuinely wished you well.
Yep.
That to me is the missing link in so much right now. And I love the fact that that's the impetus for Dark Horse. We'll take a break. When we come back, that's where we're going with Duff Gibson. He's our guest. Full hour with the Olympic gold medals from 2006 in Torino here on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Really lucky to have Duff Gibson join us in studio for a full hour. Of course, Olympic gold medalist in 2006 Torino. Turin. I get Torino or Turin. You were there. What did you call it?
Well, we were actually instructed to call it Turin.
Okay.
But Torino is the Italian word for their city. So right. I don't understand why it's not, you know, if I call myself Duff, it doesn't matter what it's pronounced in another way. It's a name. I don't get it.
My assumption is that we're all going to find out that it's actually called Rio here in 3 weeks, but I don't. Anyway, Olympic gold medalist, which can never be taken away. The story is fantastic, and it leads us to the next part of the story, which continues. And I just love the fact that you were inspired by the Olympics in 76. I was inspired in 84 by Willie DeWitt, which led to a really rocky six-month love affair with boxing that didn't work out. But that's nonetheless, that's what the Olympics are supposed to do. And we'll talk about the Olympics in a second. But we just talked about something that I thought was really kind of important, which was one of the sparks for you in 76 was this idea of sportsmanship and an example that you were shown at the Olympics. And then one of the things that you said that you loved about competing was the fact that you could go head-to-head with a guy, but he would genuinely be wishing you well, which I think is amazing. Which brings us now to Dark Horse Athletics and kind of the next chapter in your life, Dub. Because those are related, are they not? That's
absolutely
part of the reason, right?
Yeah. I retired from coaching after Sochi so that I could be more involved in my own kids' sporting experiences, and I was shocked at the negativity. There were aspects to it where I thought there is something wrong here, and it just seems wrong. I can't really put my finger on it.
Right.
And the more I watched, the more I read, the more I thought about it, I started to realize that we are doing things wrong on a mass scale in terms of youth sport. And negativity is what, I mean, that's a very simple way that I express it, but it comes down to, from all the, here's my overall summary. We make it too much about winning, and that ties into what we were just talking about.
Yep.
So maybe let's start there, because the other is early specialization. We make it too much about winning, whereas the person who wishes you to do your best is free of the anxiety. You can't make things so much about winning and winning so important without simultaneously making losing shameful and humiliating.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Right.
And so you look at Michael Jordan as an example that I use. There's someone who I've read a couple articles about him, and people say his greatest strength wasn't his athleticism. It was that he was fearless. Fearless of what? Fearless of losing. He has no fear. Taking that last shot,
yep,
he's not burdened with, oh, I hope I don't miss this. That was how I would define the best athletes I came in contact with, let alone the best athletes that I competed against. They want you to be your best. They're not burdened with being afraid of competition, afraid of losing. They have no fear of it. They don't want to win because you had a bad day. They'd rather earn it. And that's a very liberating and you know, it's a whole bunch of negativity that you don't have to worry yourself with.
So because this has been very much a timeline conversation, let me change it into more of a back and forth, and I'll play the role of devil's advocate because this is a topic that I'm very passionate about. Can you take the importance of winning out without it becoming, so you're talking about participation medals for everybody and not keeping score. That seems to be the fallback for any argument or conversation that we have about youth sports is, oh, you want to make them soft. Oh, you're going to take away the learning. They got to learn by losing, and they got to fear losing. It seems to me that what you're talking about is counterintuitive to this kind of argument.
Well, that's the traditional
right
counterpoint.
Right.
And that one to me doesn't make, here's what pops into my head when you say that. I've heard, you know, my kids are still young. They're 9 and 11. So they've only been playing sports for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard with every team each of one of them has been on, I've heard at least one parent say, I kind of wish my kid would cry after they lose. Like some kids cry after they lose. And then there's my kid who's wondering why kids are crying.
Right.
And I've had one parent with every team say, I wish my kid would cry because it will show me that they want to win, that they're invested. But that's a negative experience. There's no getting around it. And yes, certain kids will react to that by training harder and redoubling their efforts and being what the stereotype of that argument parent wants them to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a mountain of research as to why kids participate and why they quit.
Right.
And the number one, it's not the only reason. There are many reasons. And, you know, when you're 14, there's a lot of other influences. And, but the number one reason every time is because it's too serious. successful athletes, I can tell you, you know, from Michael Jordan references and the professional side of it is I have a limited experience with, but there's evidence to say that the best aren't afraid of losing.
Right.
From my perspective as an Olympic gold medalist and world champion and Olympic coach, the best athletes I know aren't afraid of losing. They don't find it humiliating. If you're ranked 25th in the world, and you're humiliated by losing, how are you going to stick it out until you're vying for medals? You have a passion for it and you want to learn. And that's my position with Dark Horse. Kids sport should be about fun and learning something.
Right.
And shocking, Olympic sport is exactly the same thing. It needs to be fun, or you would say you need to be passionate about it. But bottom line is there needs to be some force that makes you want to do it again or go to the gym and train harder next year or whatever it is. For a kid, there needs to be some force that makes them want to play baseball or hockey.
Right.
And they need to learn something. If you're an Olympian, you're ranked 25th in the world, it's about becoming a student of your sport. And you get a little, and there, because there's so many, it's not just trying harder. To use skeleton as an example, every year I try to adapt my equipment better to myself and the conditions on any given track.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole bunch of testing and learning that you have to do. How your body reacts to a certain training stimulus and how much recovery you need and does it work for you or not. There's learning 24/7 involved in the sport. And with kids, it should be about learning. It should be about growth. We shouldn't humiliate them if they lose. That doesn't make them tougher.
Right.
We think it makes them tougher.
Right.
But I don't know if you're familiar with Carol Dweck's research about fixed versus variable mindset. We're not making a generation of winners. We're teaching kids to avoid situations in which they'll lose. That's what the research is saying. So, you know, you want your kid to be tough. Your kid's going to, you know, if your kid plays sport, they're going to be in situations in which they're brokenhearted.
Right.
And you want that because it makes it fun when it does work. But if it was easy, that's the old expression.
No,
if it was
absolutely
easy, everyone would do it, right?
Right. It's one of the things that I've seen, because I do follow you on Twitter and social media. One of the things that you have put out in the past that I really do appreciate is we have to celebrate the achievement. We have to celebrate just the growth, the individual, not necessarily wins. Wins, yeah, for sure. But you just talk about personal bests, that necessity of acknowledging that I have improved. That I don't think we do that well enough in this society.
No. And that's sort of one of the foundations of the program.
Right.
And as a consequence, we've had a couple of experiences, like a little girl named Soraya, skinny, skin and bones, tiny 9-year-old, you know, shy, doesn't want to disturb you, wonders if there's other girls in the program that she could, you know, be friends with, that sort of thing. And then, do you know what a Russian twist is?
No.
People listening might not know what a Russian twist is. Yeah. It's you cross your legs, you're sitting on the ground,
yeah,
feet off the ground, and you take a medicine ball and you tap it on the floor on the left and then on the right, and you just go back and forth. Well, this tiny little soft-spoken thing did 120 Russian twists with a 10-pound medicine ball. And if we were looking for who was the fastest runner or who dominated the basketball game and rewarded that person only, you would never have found that. And that's amazing. And it is truly amazing. Like, show me 5 grownups who can do that.
Absolutely.
But that's what we should celebrate, is growth and development and getting better. And that's true of, I can tell you from first personal experience that that's what it is on an Olympic level. Because if you're ranked 25th in the world, you're about getting to 24, then 23 and 22. And so it should be no different with the kids. And it all comes back to, you can't make winning really, really important without making losing a horrible experience for a young person. That's it in a nutshell.
Duff Gibson from Dark Horse Athletics, our guest here on the Big Show on Sportsnet 960, The Fan. All right, let's deal with the one that, unfortunately, I wish we had somebody in this room that felt different than us, because I think we're both going to sing from the same hymn book on this. But early specialization, I know this is another issue for you. I certainly have been exploring it for the last couple of years. I have yet to come across somebody who's told me proven to me that there's any benefit to it. I've come across lots of harm. I've come across lots of professional coaches that bemoan it. What about early specialization, Duff?
Well, I think the problem is that in the short term it does work. And so that's why you get people going back to it and back to it. And there's, and like we were saying off the air, there are companies that exist by people, parents who are afraid that their kids will be left behind.
Yep.
The research is really clear in a few of the aspects of early specialization. One is frequency of injury and severity of injury. The earlier you specialize, the more of an uphill climb you've got in that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really up for debate in terms of what the research says. What I didn't anticipate until I came across it was that the earlier you specialize, the more likely you are to lead a sedentary lifestyle after you retire from your sport. I would describe that in this way. It's been a job for you.
Right.
And then when you're done, why would you do that for fun? It never occurs to you. So that's what the research is saying. The earlier you specialize, the more likely you are to lead a sedentary lifestyle when you retire. That's just the data. And I think that parents either aren't aware of that or they justify it based on the fact that they don't want their kid to be left behind. But there's one, like the challenge with research in this area is that it's often a very small sample size, or you're trying to extrapolate a student population to an athletic population.
Right.
And someone, you know, Steve Norris,
yep,
pointed me in the right direction and said, you got to read this. Here's another article. Look at this study. And there's basically, like, there's a lot of moving parts to this article, to this whole concept.
Agreed. Yeah.
And so there's one study that I refer to fairly regularly because it's 1,600 test subjects. So that's, for this population, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And the test subjects are German national team athletes. There aren't really any other countries in the world with a better Olympic team if you combine summer and winter than Germany. So these are elite, elite athletes. And it's longitudinal study, European Journal of Exercise Physiology, published in 2014. So it's current. It's as good as you can get in terms of research gets. And what it's, the overall conclusions of the study are very cut and dry. The earlier you start sport, the earlier you specialize in sport, the more high-intensity sport-specific training you do in your sport, those three factors are highly correlated with adolescent sporting success. And as I say, I think that's part of the problem, because in the short term, it pays off. It works. From skill acquisition alone, it pays off. But in terms of, you know, that begs the question, what's associated with senior level success? And so what they studied was national team athletes versus, or sorry, national level athletes.
Yep.
So athletes who are maybe would be a provincial team, but will top out at a national championships, and the athletes who actually represent Germany internationally. And the difference between those two are, or what's associated with success as a senior level, is how late you start sport, how late you specialize, and how many other sports you participate in. So in other words, all the justification we have for, you know, pushing our kids and allowing them or forcing them, as the case may be, because a lot of parents are, mm-hmm, you know, the kids want to do it. That's, mm-hmm, that's absolutely true. For allowing them to specialize all year round pays off in the short term, but ultimately you're sacrificing their long-term athletic potential.
One of the pushbacks that I've heard on this conversation is, well, and it comes from people that I have a lot of respect for. I don't think these are dumb people. I don't think these are, you know, people out of their element. I think they're people that are plugged in, but they just feel like the machine, and I'm not talking about any one sport, but, you know, let's say hockey, because that's the one that everybody talks about now, 12-month-a-year hockey, spring hockey, and that.
Yeah.
That the machine is such that if my son does not continue along with his teammates in the spring and summer, to your point, short term, he'll be left behind, he'll be playing below, and somehow he won't stay where he's supposed to be. How do you respond to that? Because I'm positive you've come across that.
Right. Well, it's not, you know, the way I'm presenting it and the way you're hearing it from the other side.
Yeah.
There's gray area. Absolutely, there's gray area. Figure skating and gymnastics seem to be sports where you reach a peak at such a young age that you have no choice but to, you know, if you want to,
sure,
represent your Olympic team in figure skating, you, yeah, have to start as a young kid. Hockey, I would have always thought, was in that category also. That was my,
mm-hmm,
impression, because it's a very skill-based sport. And yet, I've seen at least one study saying that NHLers typically don't play at a high level when they're young, and they start to become serious at about age 14. What occurred to me while you were leading up to that is what I sometimes tell parents is, which is just stick with it till you're 14, and then 70% of the kids will quit, and now you're in the top 30%. So so whatever it takes to avoid, you know, this whole thing can boil down. I do all the reading, and I've read the research and all the thinking about it, and I have a buddy who said the average high performance athlete competes at that high international level for 9 years. Do you want to use up a year or two with novice hockey? And I think that's exactly what's happening.
Right.
Because there's the physical side. I mean, we can talk athleticism, and there's the mental side. And kids quit because it's not funny. Like you, even junior level hockey, junior A hockey.
For sure.
Why you still do it? Because to me, it's still fun. Why did you quit? I'm not having fun anymore. So it's not just a 14-year-old, a 13-year-old that's going to say that. That's pervasive. So that, you know, you can't avoid the mental side of it.
He's Duff Gibson. Dark Horse Athletic is the company. When we come back, we'll tell you a little bit about it, what they're up to. Also want to pick his brain on a couple other big topics, but this has been a lot of fun. Duff Gibson in studio with us, Sportsnet 960, The Fan. Only wish that the minutes or the hours around here were 80 minutes, not 60 minutes. Unfortunately, one last segment with our pal Duff Gibson. 2006 Olympic gold medalist in Torino in skeleton, and also the founder of Dark Horse Athletics, which is a Calgary-based company and group. We've talked about the ideals, but let's talk about the practicality. What is Dark Horse Athletic? Who should be looking you up and who should be using you?
Well, I say Dark Horse Athletic is about athleticism, and it's about fun and teaching kids, you know, why we do this in the first place. And there's free play. Course is an hour. It sometimes, my wife is always saying, shorter response. You got to tell people what it is in 30 seconds or less. But it's a very complicated thing. It's the classes are an hour 15, and 15 of that is run around the gym, shoot hoops, throw the football, do whatever you want. Free play. Then we do a track warm-up, because if you play baseball or soccer or basketball, you've very likely never been taught how to run properly. And so being a skeleton athlete, and I have a bobsledder and a national track athlete who are instructors, we'll teach kids how to run properly in the proper hip motion. We'll do the ABCs and strides and that sort of thing. So that's our warm-up. And then we divide into groups, and we do 8 or 10 minutes in three different stations typically. And sometimes it's basketball, volleyball, football, throwing things, catching things, jumping, whatever it is. And it's constantly moving. Everyone is doing something the whole time. And we also have a station that's, I call circus stunts, which is a bench flipped upside down. So it's like a balance beam or wobble boards. And then it's dribbling on a wobble board or heading a soccer ball back to someone while you're on a balance beam or standing on one foot, and all these different kinds of things that is just about physical literacy. And then we end, because a lot of the kids in the program are either hockey, ringette, or skiing. We have Jessica Gregg, who's an Olympic silver medalist in speed skating, teach them low walks and some of the training that speed skaters do just to strengthen the legs in that specific range of motion. And so that translates, you know, if you don't have the strength to use the proper range of motion, you're not going to skate properly the way a speed skater, everything is how they skate. And then we end with more free time. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's physical literacy. It's running, jumping. It's athleticism.
So I think you answered one of the questions in there, though. It's, you know, it's for athletes that are in other sports. It's complementary to that. Yep. My assumption, based on one of the stories you told, is that maybe you're not in sports. Maybe this is just a way of being active and physical, right?
Well, that sort of ties into another sort of marketing strategy that we're going through, which is my kids are just finished grade 3 and grade 6. At their school, there really isn't much of a physical education program. And my eldest son is going to grade 7, where there will be a basketball team next year.
Right.
And he wants to try that. And he's going to try out, but he's never played basketball before. So Dark Horse, in a sense, fills that void, because physical literacy tells us that by grade 6 is a very key moment.
Yep.
And if you've never been taught not how to pass or play a game, but dribble. How you feel, how you spread your fingers out and you feel the ball with the fingertips, and how you dribble and how you can do that without looking at it. If you've never been taught how to do that, then after grade, it's not like you're going to start playing basketball at age 20 or something. So that's part of it. And that's why I think Dark Horse should be in schools. Like, this is the kind of thing that every kid should learn. And it's not, we're not kicking kids out who aren't successful or putting them at the, you know, teaching them that winning is wrong, because it's about growth. And as I mentioned before, we've had some really stellar performances from, you know, kids that you would never expect to be wonderfully talented in one aspect of it. And they really enjoy it and they get a little better and they want to come back. So that's success from our perspective.
Well, and the one thing, you kind of walked through the schedule, but I think it's also important to point out, based on the conversation before, is, yeah, they're doing these things, but it's all interconnected with the principles and the base that you come at, that celebrate your successes and don't, you know, become fearless and, you know, sportsmanship, all the things that have kind of peppered through this conversation. It really is a life's work kind of coming to a culmination here.
It is. It is. And before we do our warm up, we have 10 minutes, we begin with 5 minutes of free time. We roughly, and we end with 10 minutes of free time. After the 5 minutes, they've been running around. We bring them all in and I give them what I call a 2-minute lecture. And the first day the lecture is, why do we do this? Why do you play sports in the first place? And the kids aren't the ones that need the lecture a lot of the times, but they're, you know, they say for fun and to be healthier. That's right. You know, so you give them something to think about, and it extends from there. Like, own it. Someone would say own it is a very complex concept for an 8-year-old.
Right.
But as an Olympic team coach, I'm trying to teach that to a 35-year-old. It's too late. You know, what is the concept? A successful person takes responsibility for their mistakes. An unsuccessful person blames the referee. That's why they lost. It's because the referee, you know, it's not our fault. So it's something to think about. It's only 2 minutes. Then we try and instill that it's about growth and fun and development by what we do in the actual game. Like, we have challenges. And if you can, you know, doing 130 or 120 French twists or Russian twists with a medicine ball, that was acknowledged by the whole group because that was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
darkhorseathletic.ca. That is the website. That's where people can get information.
Yep. Yep.
A little quiet right now, but it kicks up again in the fall, right?
Right. And we've changed the format a little bit.
Okay.
Our first go round, it was Monday and Thursday, and you pick the time that you come. And we had people saying, can we come Monday because we got baseball or whatever? So now it's Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, 7 p.m. at Weber Academy. And you sign up for once or twice a week, whatever you want. And then when you don't have hockey, when you don't have lacrosse or soccer, whatever it is, you come on whatever day you can make it. So got some really good feedback about that so far.
Congratulations on this. This is phenomenal. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Unfortunately, we're running up against the clock. And I do want to pick your brain on something that I think is very important based on the start to this conversation, that you were inspired by the 1976 Olympics. This has been a tough run up to the Rio Games. It's a lot of things that, you know, the IOC is besmirched for reasons that they brought them to themselves. The Russians are right now, we're watching this systematic doping, which is mind-blowing. You know, Rio itself has these struggles, yet I feel like we have to report on this. We have to talk. We do need to hold these people accountable, but we can't lose the importance of the Olympic ideal, the Olympic movement. The Olympic movement is important, even though all of these things swirling around it are nasty and dark. The Olympic movement itself, the true ideals of why the Olympics began, are very important.
I think that's the only reason why I'm frustrated by it, is the Olympic ideal. And why, you know, for me, it's Rio is one aspect to it, but it's Sochi was a real eye-opener for me that, you know, my wife started up this Calgary Run for Water, where we're trying to raise $10,000 for a clean water project in Ethiopia. And Russia has so many poor people, and they spend $54 billion hosting a Winter Olympics. It's completely changed. We're on a bit of a tangent as to what this should be about.
Right.
And if I wasn't for, you know, six host cities and rotating the Olympics before, I sure am now. And that's why I would support a Calgary bid, because we have the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And you might have to upgrade. You got to redo the ski jumps or,
sure.
You know, there's a number of things that we'd have to do, but on a bigger scale, that's what the Olympics needs, because it's so obviously about money. I mean, golf, a lot of this conversation going back and forth on Facebook recently, should tennis be in the Olympics when there's a Wimbledon?
Yep.
You know,
yep.
But it's obvious why golf and tennis are in the Olympics. And I'm excited to watch Brooke Henderson, to be honest, who might win a medal in it. But it's sad that X Games type stuff and really wealthy sports like golf, tennis, that sort of thing, that's what's moving into the Olympics. And for a moment, we were considering pulling wrestling out of the Olympics, like one of the original ancient Olympic sports, where for wrestling, that's your 5 minutes to be on television, is once every 4 years if you're lucky enough to be there. And I'm disillusioned about it, to be frank. So.
Well, I understand why you're disillusioned, but I applaud you for being, you know, the ideal of what the Olympic movement is. You were inspired as a child. You followed it through 5 different sports, I believe we counted.
Yeah.
You win at 39, and now you're giving back to the game.